It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The American Heart Association estimates we consume around 60 pounds of added sugar each year. And they put it another way. That's the size of 6 bowling balls weighing 10 pounds each. We go deeper on the world's largest crop with help from a new investigative podcast series. And you can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question or comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Celeste Headlee is a journalist and host of Big Sugar. It's a podcast from iHeartMedia and Imagine Entertainment, delving into the multi-billion-dollar sugar industry. Celeste, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Your podcast, telling the story of sugarcane production on American soil and through decades. Why is this story so important, so relevant to share today?
Well, the main reason is that the Farm Bill is up for reconsideration this year, which is a massive, massive piece of legislation most people don't pay a lot of attention to. And it only comes up for reconsideration every 4 years. And the sugar program is a multi-billion dollar piece of the Farm Bill. And so this is the moment when we need to reconsider the sugar industry and whether it's worth billions of our tax dollars.
What are the subsidies and the profits like for sugar growers? What's at stake in the Farm Bill?
So these sugar subsidies were put into place decades ago as part of the effort during the World War, when they were concerned that we might have to rely on sugar from other countries and then not have enough sugar. It has been obviously quite a long time since we had to worry about that as a nation, but the sugar subsidies are still in there, which basically guarantees sugar growers a certain price for the sugar. It incentivizes companies to grow sugar. So they are getting billions of dollars to grow sugar. As I mentioned, it is worth billions to a very small number of sugar companies that are owned by a small number of basically people, families in many cases. And yet, our sugar in the United States costs more to the American consumer than it does in almost every other developed nation. So taxpayers are paying for sugar in a number of ways, and I'm sure it will come out over the course of this conversation. We're also paying for it in healthcare and the environment, but just through the sugar program in the Farm Bill, our sugar is very expensive indeed.
You had aha moments throughout this investigation. What surprised you most after investigating the sugar industry?
I think, number one, I don't think I realized just how hard it is and always has been to get sugar to our tables. Mm-hmm. I don't think I really, really took that in. Hearing the stories of these Jamaican workers, you know, cutting sugar cane, which is mostly done now using machines in the United States, but it's still cut by hand in many other places. Hearing these Jamaican workers talk about what they went through, because American workers were not going to do it. And so these companies would bring in immigrant workers through our migrant worker programs to cut it, and them talking about what they went through, it was kind of horrifying, frankly.
Using machetes?
Yeah, they would be in armor because these machetes were so sharp that if you make a mistake, you're standing there in the hot Florida, Louisiana sun all day long for 8 hours, and you're expected to cut 8 tons of cane. And I don't know, Kate, if you've ever had your hands on a cane?
I used to live in Louisiana, and there were
fields all around. These massive plants, right? Sometimes they grow way above your head.
Yes.
They are thick. Some of them take both your hands to get around them. They feel like wood, like they are thick. And so these machetes are incredibly sharp. They can easily cut straight through your flesh and into bone. They're wearing armor. It becomes this just rote robotic movement for these men. So you can imagine what that does to your body over the course of a day of doing this same movement. I mean, just the description of what happened and the injuries that occurred, and they would get short periods of a break for lunch where they would get maybe a bowl with rice and perhaps some beans in it. They didn't get a break for water. I just, it never Putting a spoonful of sugar into my coffee in the morning, I didn't make that connection.
We're talking about the multi-billion-dollar sugar industry through the decades. Celeste Headlee, host of the podcast called Big Sugar. You can join in with your questions, share your concerns at 800-642-1234. Celeste, your podcast stems from the 1980s book called Big Sugar and a 2001 investigation by Vanity Fair. What has changed since these decades-old investigations? I mean, you mentioned technology changes, and, you know, I would imagine, too, there are now, sugar harvesters and farm implements that we're not having to do this by hand.
That is one thing that has changed. And at least in the United States, they are using sugar harvesters. The United States is one of the top five producers of sugar in the world. The other four big producers, like China and other places, still often harvest by hand, though. Some other things really have not changed all that much. I got to be honest with you. Much of the sugar industry looks exactly the same way that it did 20 years ago, when Marie was writing this piece about the landmark court case, this massive court case in which these Jamaican workers were trying to get back the wages that were stolen from them, and they were not successful in doing so. You know, the sugar industry goes back obviously hundreds of years. It is not possible to separate the sugar industry from slave labor because it is so labor intensive. Even though the harvesters themselves has been mechanized, sugar is still a labor intensive industry. It still requires a massive number of people to work those harvesters, to get it to the processing plants, to get it into bags. Every step along the way still requires a large number of people, and that will continue to be the truth for a long period of time.
A research fellow you interviewed for Slate magazine says the industry is similar to a cartel. Is that an accurate description?
Yeah, that was a research fellow with the Cato Institute, who called them candy-coated cartel. I mean, obviously, that's not a one-to-one comparison. Yeah, obviously that's metaphoric. But in terms of the fact that there's this massive amount of secrecy, that this is the power of this industry is that is incredible, that they pull levers of power that I think most of us are not aware. Let me give you an example. And this is a story that we tell in the podcast that Marie Brenner told in her original Vanity Fair article 20 years ago. So when Bill Clinton was still president, at one point he was breaking up with Monica Lewinsky and telling her it was over. And he had told his aides he did not want to be disturbed, and he was in the Oval Office. And a call comes through on his phone, and he said, "I didn't want to be disturbed." And the aide says, "Mr. President, it's Alfie von Huel," who was one of the CEOs of U.S. Sugar. And the president says, "I'll take that call." That's how powerful these sugar barons are. And they always have been. They have manipulated not just politics through the incredible wealth they use, but science, environmental policy, real estate. I mean, when you talk about a cartel, it's mass. The influence on our lives, our labor policy, our wages, it's massive. It's incredible the way it has influenced the way that we live.
Celeste Headlee hosts an investigative podcast series. It's called Big Sugar, focusing on the multi-billion-dollar sugar industry and the forces within it. You can join the conversation with your question, share concerns at any point. The number is 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Sugar can be found in foods we eat every day, and a new investigative podcast examines the industry's political power, its treatment of sugarcane harvesters, and public health effects of eating too much sugar. You can add a question or share at any point in the discussion. Call 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Journalist Celeste Headley is host of Big Sugar and stays with us. Let's bring in Jane in Oconomowoc. Jane, hi. What is your question?
Hi, good morning. I lived in southwestern Minnesota for several years, and there is one crop there is sugar beets. And I'm wondering if you can speak to the influence of the sugar beet crop on the sugar industry, and if that has made any difference in workers and how they're treated. And because the cooperative in the city where I lived, the town rather, where I lived was the main employer.
Jane, thank you for that question. Neighboring Minnesota producing roughly one-third of all sugar beets in America. Celeste, what can you say there about the role of sugar beets?
Yeah, I mean, sugar beets produce a significant portion of sugar in the United States. I think somewhere around 35% or so, still over half, 65% or so comes from sugarcane in the United States. But the sugarcane producers don't have to worry about sugar beets because of the farm bill. Just to go back to that, remember, they are protected from any competition because our government literally pays them to plant sugar. It guarantees them a price for sugar. In order to force the sugar industry, Big Sugar, to have to compete in a fair market, we would have to kill the sugar program, which, this is one of the reasons we did this podcast this year, is to encourage people who want to have their voices known to think about possibly where $2 to $4 billion of taxpayer money could be spent if it weren't going to pay sugar barons to plant sugar. What other things could we spend that on, and call their representatives? Because yeah, they're being paid, so they don't have to worry about sugar beet producers.
Why is the sugar industry have so much political sway, so much savvy and pull in Washington? Why is that?
Because they're so wealthy. I mean, imagine for a moment that you have this product that everybody wants, right? And you're still also being paid to sell this product. And you're making money coming and going. They're very, very wealthy. They have a lot of money. And so they spread it around, and they're quite savvy politically in that if you go and look at the political donations made by many of these sugar producers, they're not donating to one party. They're donating very liberally, lowercase l, to both parties. And so they become important donors across the board. They don't just get a Democratic president on the phone, they get a Republican on the phone as well. They are important to both parties, to all parties. That's what makes them so very important. And so both of the political parties are willing to protect their interests. They also often make the case when it comes to the farm bill, they make this case that they are farmers. They make this sentimental appeal that, we're American farmers and we should protect American farmers. And I would think most people don't, that's not what they think of when we think about, a small time family American farmer, but they're quite good at making that case. So when it all comes down though, to is just billions of dollars.
And then why is it, though, that sugarcane producing farmers get these subsidies, whereas in our parts where sugar beets are produced, those farmers aren't getting the same types of subsidies?
Yeah, it all just goes back to the origins of that sugar subsidy, going back to the war era when, there was concern that that was still at the time when we did not have an obesity crisis. They felt that sugar was necessary for energy that they needed to keep, not just soldiers, but all the people working on in the factories going. They needed energy. They needed to make sure everyone was working at their best. That required sugar, and they were afraid that they would run out of sugar. And so they wanted to protect that industry. They wanted to protect that commodity. And so they put subsidies in there to make sure that farmers would always have a guaranteed price for sugar. And it is a relic of that time, basically, because every single time the Farm Bill came up for reauthorization, the sugar producers would lavish donations on politicians and they would vote to reauthorize that sugar subsidies. It's still there.
Celeste Headlee, host of the podcast Big Sugar. You can join in with your questions about the sugar industry, 800-642-1234. Ernest in Hayward now. Ernest, what is your question?
I've read a lot about the subsidies of corn in the state of Florida that have polluted and caused destruction to the wetlands in Florida. And then there's the corn subsidies too, giving us high fructose corn syrup, which is contaminated groundwater and our own health and groundwater in the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico through the use of synthetic fertilizers and pesticides. So, but Florida is really a basket case because of the corn subsidies down there.
Ernest, thank you. What are the environmental realities in growing sugar, in growing these crops, Celeste?
Yeah, it's pretty devastating to the environment, and it's partly because the regulations are not there. And again, this is because of wielding political influence to avoid having those regulations put on their industry means that the industry has been dumping chemical fertilizers and pesticides straight into the marsh. The Everglades have now been polluted by phosphorus, not just in Florida, but as you know, in Louisiana as well. Nitrogen, mercury, that's caused some really devastating algae blooms. A lot of the natural plants and animals have died. There also is an incredible amount of air pollution. Why? Because the cheapest way to get rid of the stubs of cane is to simply burn them. So they burn almost 500,000 acres of sugarcane for 6 to 8 months out of the year. And there's a lot of critters that don't make it out that simply die in these fires. And so instead of doing a more environmentally safe way of refreshing those fields, they just burn them down because they're not required to do anything else. Part of the podcast, we went down and visited some of these fields. We parked at one point in an elementary school, and it was right next door to one of these sugarcane fields where they were burning. And I stepped out of the car, and in less than a minute, I was covered in this thick ash. And I looked to my right, and all of the playground equipment was just coated in thick black ash. Yeah.
How water intensive is this crop?
That's another thing. It also requires a great deal of water as well. Sugarcane, often you will, if you go down to a sugar field, and again, you have seen this before, it sometimes is in standing water. And so it's a very, for the environment, it is a very cost intensive crop in every possible way. The problem is that every single time people have tried to take even the smallest steps to try and put regulations on to force the industry to,
Into adapting
adapt
sustainable.
even in any way, even tiny little bits, right? How they how they truck their products, how they transport things. It's been over tens of millions of dollars end up going, and then it gets defeated. Mm. There was an attorney general in Florida that filed a lawsuit, which I think is still ongoing at this point, which there have been lawsuits filed before. The Everglades Health Foundation has tried. They've tried through the Army Corps of Engineers to
multiple
try and
ways. Yes. Celeste Headley, we're going to pause here, host of the investigative podcast series Big Sure, looking at how industry practices affect our world. You can join in 800-642-1234. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The agricultural lobby, the American Sugar Alliance, it says sugar is an essential ingredient in our nation's food supply, made from two different crops we've been talking about, sugar beets and sugar cane. A new investigative podcast exposes harsh worker conditions in sugarcane production and the power of this industry. Call in with a question or comment at any point, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Journalist Celeste Headley is host of the podcast series called Big Sugar. Celeste, we heard from Linda in Appleton who called in, and Linda is wondering about the pushback you received from the sugar industry because of this podcast. How did the American Sugar Alliance respond?
They had a couple responses. The first is they felt we were focusing on a 20-year-old case, which is true. Part of the story we tell is about a class action lawsuit that began 20 years ago. That's true. But we bring the story obviously up to present times. The other thing is that they talk about the number of people that they employ, that they're an important part of American business. What you just said, that sugar is a part of people's diets and they rely on us and they're a good part of an American capitalist business. So all those things are true. They employ a lot of people. They are a corporate member of American society. No argument here.
Let's talk about the court case following lawyers who filed this class action lawsuit in the 80s over millions of dollars in lost wages for sugarcane cutters. And let's listen to lawyer Edward Tuddenham on his discovery that workers weren't receiving their promised wages.
You had to cut over a ton and a half per hour, and people just couldn't do it. People clearly were not cutting fast enough. They just couldn't, physically could not. I don't care whether you're an Olympic champion, you cannot cut cane that fast.
So what happened with this court case?
Some of the sugar producers settled. There was one sugar company that did not, and we focus on the two brothers that own that company, two men born in Cuba who fled to the United States after Castro took over, the Funhools. And that ended up being a very long, drawn-out case. Essentially, in the first time they went to court, the judge immediately issued them a ruling in their favor, a massive ruling in their favor, and they appealed. And then it ended up getting drawn out over years and years and years. And in the end, well, I don't want to tell you that. Let people listen. but the workers don't get their lost wages. Let me just say that. Mm. And this is something that all Americans, frankly, we should feel ashamed for. I mean, these workers literally gave their blood to get sugar onto our tables, and we did not treat them well. And they were earning very, very, very little, and their employers stole some of that from them. But I think, you know, one of the reasons we needed to go back to retell this case is because, A, we needed to update it with what has happened since. But also, it's really important to understand the sugar industry's place in labor history in the United States, its place in immigration history, because it really had a lot of influence on our government's attitude toward migrant workers and the policies that are still in place today. And, you know, what happens? Because if one of those workers were not up to par, according to their employers, if they got injured, if they weren't cutting enough cane or working hard enough, the threat was always there that they would simply deport them.
Hmm.
You know, that gave them an amount of power, which is just, that's a lot of power. But they also had them in just very dire conditions. The places where they were had them living and forcing them to pay for their food and these rooms. It was just awful.
The Von Hul family, the maker of Domino Sugar, and you know, I think about my own complicity. I mean, I put my sugar cube just a couple hours ago, my Domino sugar cube, into my Earl Grey tea. How do we reconcile with this, Celeste?
So I have not been able to. First I tried to go without sugar, and which was very difficult and over time became impossible for me. It's not impossible. And there's going to be people who call in and say, I am now without sugar. And I tip my hat to you because it's hard. It's very hard. They put sugar in a lot of things. By the way, Domino Sugar is also CNH Sugar. It's Florida Crystals. It's Red Path. They own a lot of things. I found the Wholesome Sugar Company. They are not part of these big sugar companies. Hmm. It's really difficult. I mean, I think, you know, the thing of it is, Kate, is there's so much in life that is when you pull back the curtain, there's ugliness behind it. And it's almost too much for your average human being to bear. Mm. And so it's impossible for all of us to have to bear that burden for everything in our lives. I mean, it's too much. But the time has come for sugar, right? Like, there was a reckoning for tobacco. There's the beginning of a reckoning for this pharmaceutical industry, and it's time for sugar to have its reckoning. And we do have to bear this for a moment. It's time for us to think about how that sugar is getting to our table and to come up with a better solution.
Celeste Headley with us, host of the investigative podcast series Big Sugar, as we look at the multi-billion-dollar sugar industry over time. And you can join in at any point. Call in with a question. Share your concerns at 800-642-1234. Celeste, you were going here for just a bit, but Lynn from Wausau called in and is wondering if there are more ethical ways for us consumers to buy and use sugar. And Lynn asks, is beet sugar, for instance, more ethical to use than cane sugar?
No, it is not, I'm afraid. It also is not environmentally safe. Some of the companies that I've been talking about also own a great number of beet fields. You have to actually do the research on the company itself. I ended up tracking down, like I was talking about, the Wholesome Sugar Company, mm-hmm. which I'm a journalist. I don't know the people who own Wholesome, mm-hmm. but I did my own research on them. They launched in 2001 and they were a fair trade company, and they have consciously sourced ingredients that are also keep an eye toward climate change. So you have to, you have to do your own research and find them. In terms of sugar, that's one of the few, it's not the only, believe me, but you have to do your own research to find somebody who is producing it in an ethical way. And it's gonna cost you a little more. You can try to replace it with honey. That's not going to work in all of your baking. But it's so hard. And the other thing about this that makes it so difficult is because the sugar industry has been remarkably successful in getting sugar into so many parts of our food items that it does not belong in. It's in beef jerky. It's in vitamins. It's in some toothpaste. It's in bread. It's in so many things. And if you think it's not, that's partially because there are so many names for sugar that you do not recognize. In fact, if you go and Google it, you will find people who have collected all the many different names for sugar that sugar has. And that is that those lists are dozens of names long because it's updated all the time. And I had to print those lists out and keep them in my kitchen when I was trying to eliminate sugar, because you will not recognize sometimes that sugar is in your food until you realize that it's named something entirely different.
Does the industry come up with those names?
Oftentimes they do, yes. Hmm. And it's a way of adding sugar into these other products. You don't know the sugar is in there, but it is just sugar. And so you don't know that this is a Domino's food brand sugar that's in your sugar. And so you're buying a product from Alfie and Pepe Van Hool without even realizing it. It's so difficult. And it feels insidious.
Celeste Headley, journalist, host of a new podcast series examining the power of the sugar industry, calling with the question, share your concerns, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new investigative podcast series examines exploitations in the multi-billion-dollar sugar industry through decades and the political influence sugar businesses have today. As we explore the podcast called Big Sugar, call in with the question, add a comment, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Journalist and podcast host Celeste Headley stays with us. Celeste, turning to sugar in the diet, consuming excess sugar can increase the risk of serious health conditions, including type 2 diabetes. How has the sugar industry marketed the nutritional benefits of sugar?
Well, much like we saw with the tobacco industry in terms of revelations about how they influenced the science, the same sort of revelations have occurred with sugar. Essentially, research has uncovered the fact that the sugar industry really impacted what we know about sugar, and especially its influence on our cardiovascular system. And this has been pretty recent. Listeners may realize this because for a very, very long period of time, the sugar industry pressured doctors to blame fat for not just obesity, but all kinds of cardiovascular problems, heart problems and heart attacks. And so, you know, you'd go to the store and you'd see a box of licorice and it would say fat free. And so, you know, people would eat things with all kinds of sugar. I saw this ad for sugar that said, if sugar caused obesity, why are there so few fat kids? Because they eat so much sugar, right? One dentist that we talked to was researching sugar for a number of reasons. And she ended up finding the archives of a sugar company that had gone out of business. And, you know, a librarian had the archives of this sugar company. Nobody was really paying attention. These were all confidential documents. And so she found all these confidential memos in which there was all these, you know, there was the receipts, right? It was these, they were revealing how they wanted to influence the medical and scientific information on the effect of sugar. But it goes back even further in with the story of two scientists, John Yudkin and then Ansel Keys, who basically kind of personify this battle between sugar and fat in terms of our health, in which John Yudkin, a guy who grew up in a very poor Jewish Orthodox family in Britain, was studying the effect of excessive sugar and found it absolutely led in a direct line to coronary heart disease. And Ansel Keys, whose research was being funded by the sugar industry, spent his life really trying to completely discredit Dr. Yudkin and succeeded in doing so. And Ansel Keys became a rock star scientist. He was on all the talk shows. He became quite wealthy. And since then, John Yudkin's research has been absolutely upheld. He has, since his death, been enjoyed his book, Pure, White, and Deadly, has enjoyed a second run of popularity, and it's turned out that he was right all along. So yeah, it, for a very, very long period of time, our eyes were not opened to the danger of sugar. And now we know that we were eating too much.
You mentioned how the sugar industry had paid scientists in the 1960s to downplay the link between sugar and heart disease. And JAMA Internal Medicine had published those internal sugar industry documents in recent years, in 2016, really shifting the blame to saturated fat. Fast forward to the present, are there still issues now in influencing nutrition science?
Yeah, and I assume that what you're asking me this because of the recent report that came out saying that aspartame may be really, really dangerous. Mm-hmm. And of course, a large number of American scientists stepped forward immediately and said, absolutely not. There's no evidence for this. And many of them immediately said, we suspect the sugar industry is influencing this report. There was no evidence of this. Aspartame has been cleared again and again and again. But the truth is that every single time a sugar substitute starts to enjoy popularity, there is some sort of, I hate to say fear-mongering. As a journalist, it always gives me hives to use that. But yeah, there's always some kind of fear-mongering brought up. And there's really not a lot of evidence showing that. For when aspartame first came on the market, there were some very sketchy research studies claiming that it caused cancer. And it kept a lot of people from using aspartame for a long time. And it turns out those research studies have been discredited and debunked. But because the reaction with studies, research that was funded in large part by the sugar industry was quick, incisive, and highly publicized, it worked its magic. And it made people wary of using aspartame. And there's always this concern when there's a sugar substitute that it's going to happen again.
Talking about the sugar industry with Celeste Headley, host of the investigative podcast series Big Sugar. You can join in with your question, your insights, 800-642-1234. Celeste, in your reporting, did you see situations at all of any child labor violations? What could you tell us there?
I did not.
Okay.
Did not. Many of the places which you have seen recently reports of that happening were not the places where we were going. We were mostly in Florida. And like as I mentioned, the fields in Florida have been largely mechanized. So I did not. We had heard reports from people who have worked in some of the factories in which child labor has been an issue, but that was all secondhand.
In terms of the sugar that is imported then to our country, should we be concerned about child labor in other countries as we eat the sugar? Because as you mentioned, this family, the Fungul family, has sugar under a lot of different names and corporations.
Yes, we absolutely always have to be. The largest sugar producing countries in the world are the United States, as I mentioned, also Brazil, India, and Thailand and China. Sugar is a major crop, especially for Thailand, and that includes sugar produced from both sugar cane and from sugar beets. And yes, there is real issues for child labor in several of those countries. And there are a number of organizations, including the United Nations, that keep track of violations of child labor laws. And look, it's difficult for the average person to keep track of this. I don't expect everybody to do all this homework themselves. It's one of the reasons why, for me, I find it better to go and find the companies that are certified by an organization like Fair Trade Certified, etc., and let the a certification organization that does that homework for you, an organization that you trust like that, let them do the homework, because, you know, life is hard. Most of us have too much to do already.
And that recipe calls for a cupful of sugar, meanwhile.
Exactly. I mean, if you're making something from scratch and that's why you need that sugar, let somebody else do that work for you.
As you watch Capitol Hill and the Farm Bill coming together and the tensions around it, what movement is there in removing sugar subsidies from the Farm Bill in the future? What do you see?
There has not been a lot. And, you know, this is one of the things where one of the reasons why we wanted to make sure that this podcast came out this year, why I have been doing as many interviews like this one as I possibly can, is to encourage everyone to call their congressperson, to call their representatives, because normally the Farm Bill gets talked about with these warm, glowing speeches about American farmers, and it gets rubber stamped. And so I would really love to see that not happen this year. At least let there be some debate about the sugar program and perhaps some of the other things that go into the Farm Bill. We're talking about a Farm Bill which all together includes trillions of dollars of taxpayer money. And again, we are in a period of time in which we're being told as taxpayers that there are some things that we find important and a value that we don't have money for. And maybe we should be thinking more critically and more intentionally about where that money is going.
Celeste, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Celeste Headlee is a journalist and host of the investigative podcast series called Big Sugar. We have a link at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We check in now on family businesses that are an important engine of the Wisconsin economy. The resource platform Family Business estimates roughly two-thirds of all American workers are employed at family firms. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Nathan Brinkman is founder, CEO, and president of Triumph Wealth Management, based in Madison. Nathan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you.
Good morning. Yes,
good Jennifer. Morning.
Good morning. Jennifer Pendergast here as well, adjunct professor at the John L. Ward Center for Family Enterprises at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. Jennifer, welcome.
Hi, good morning.
Jennifer, let's start with you. You've made a career of studying and consulting with family-owned businesses. People might imagine small stores, family-run restaurants. What is the reality of the size and scope of family-run enterprises?
Well, they actually run the gamut, and the piece that you're saying people imagine is definitely true, and actually the backbone of our economy and great employers and people and contributors to communities. But, you know, there are also people around you like SC Johnson and Kohler companies and Cargill, and those get to be some of the largest companies in the country and employ thousands and thousands of people and have been contributing to the economy for hundreds of years.
So really, they run the gamut. I was struck by your research that says we view family firms as very, very trustworthy. What are the perceptions like of family-run businesses?
Well, it's interesting. So Edelman is a well-recognized PR firm, and they do a trust barometer every year. And occasionally they pick a target population to focus in on. A few years ago, they looked at family-owned businesses and found that in general, they are more trusted by their employees to do what they say. They have more trust in the leadership of those companies. My sense is that stems from the fact, a couple of things. One, if I have a vested interest in my company staying around for a long time, which a lot of families will say we're committed to running this for the long term, then I'm incented to do the right thing because I don't get to walk away from what I'm doing. Also, family-owned businesses are often the backbone of their community, their employers there. So the same people that own that business are sending their kids to school in the same schools and going to, you know, the same religious affiliations and in the same clubs and organizations. And so they have a vested interest to be, you know, they're recognized as people that people can see walking around the street. So they want to make sure they do the right thing. And then there's just a certain pride, I think, in a lot of these families in building quality products and providing good services and being good employers. And so that results in them, you know, I think that level of trust that you see.
Really having that sense of place. Nathan, you own a family company, work with a lot of family-owned businesses. What challenges are companies facing?
Well, it's like many other businesses out there. Families, during times of COVID, struggle with taking care of just their internal families. And then as a business owner, you're taking care of your business family as well. And so we've seen a lot of stress placed onto family business owners of taking care, if you will, of their internal families as well as their external business families. So that is something I think that's really arisen here in the last 3 years as these owners are trying to navigate through the changing times. And secondly, I would say, obviously, recently with the change of interest rates, these are generally closely held companies. And so just adjusting to the changing economic environment has been very significant as well. And as Jennifer said, many of these business owners are, we'll call them first responders to a community. They identify the needs inside of these communities. To be good people and good employers to reflect the values of the family, but also to their communities. And I think that's really important if we think about or look around what's going on in our local communities as well as the world.
First responders to a community. Nathan Brinkman there, founder and CEO of Triumph Wealth Management in Madison. Jennifer Pendergast is an adjunct professor at Northwestern University. As we talk about family businesses and get insights on them, you can join in the conversation, call in with a question or comment at 800-642-1234. Jennifer, how do family-owned businesses compare to publicly traded companies in terms of success and returns and size?
So because they don't have access to capital, as Nathan said, you know, they're reliant on either bank capital or internally generated capital, family businesses tend to be smaller than a lot of publicly held companies. They also tend to maybe grow at a more measured pace. If you want to last forever, you don't take big risks, right? So I don't take big loans from the bank because I might not be able to pay them off. I may not make an acquisition that I don't think, you know, I can run successfully. So they tend to be a lot more steady in their returns and a lot more resilient to downturns, but maybe not grow as quickly on the upside. So that's kind of how they would look financially. One of the things that I have a I guess I would say, a chip on my shoulder about, or a pet peeve, being a big advocate and supporter of family businesses, is there's a lot of research that's cited that says that a third of family businesses don't succeed to the second generation, and then only a third of those that succeeded to the second succeed to the third. So that gives you about 10% of them by the third generation. And while that data is out there, what it doesn't do is compare family-owned businesses to non-family-owned businesses. And if you look at data around the length of time that a company lasts in the Standard & Poor's 500 index, as an example, that number has dropped incredibly over the past 50 years. And so I don't think that the tenure, the duration of family businesses is any shorter than public companies. I think in many cases it's longer. I can't think of a publicly traded company CEO that would sit in front of shareholders and say, my goal is for this business to last forever. But many family businesses will say, our aspiration is that we will be a privately held family-run company for as long as possible. And what that means is we have to be flexible and adjust to changes. Maybe we need to change what businesses we're in. Cargill is not in the same businesses that Cargill was in, you know, when they started, nor is Kohler, nor a lot of these big businesses, but they've learned how to adjust and adapt so that they can be resilient over the long term. And so I think the returns over time can be higher, but they're definitely more resilient.
And we're going to put a pin in succession. We're going to definitely go there. But Nathan, you know, these businesses can be complicated. There's the family. There's the actual business. There might be other ownership. What advantages or disadvantages do family businesses have over other ownership models?
Well, I would say the first one would be reflection of values. As Jennifer was stating, you know, families are incredibly intimate, and generally you see core values transferred from generation to generation, and we see that inside of businesses as well. I was recently at a presentation by Helen Johnson Leopold, and she talked about how Sam Johnson, as he was turning the tide of SC Johnson, sat down with the family first and really enforce those core values. Mm. And when you see that, as Jennifer was stating, that resonates throughout an industry, it resonates throughout a business or a corporation. So we see them as being really resilient and reflecting core values. That's also evident in companies like Menards, which is a Wisconsin-based, closely held business by a family. We see that locally with Epic, in Madison, where incredible leaders who are leading forward based on their core principles, their core values, which, not to say that doesn't exist in publicly held companies. However, we just see it so much more reinforced and intimately held within family business.
Nathan Brinkman, founder of Triumph Wealth Management in Madison. Jennifer Pendergast is an adjunct professor of family enterprises at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. As we discuss businesses owned and controlled by families, you can call in with a question, share your perspectives, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Family-owned businesses, they contribute greatly to Wisconsin's economy, but they face unique challenges. According to the Wisconsin Family Business Center, there's space to talk. Call in with a question. You can add your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Nathan Brinkman is founder and CEO of an investment and financial planning firm in Madison. Jennifer Pendergast is a family enterprise consultant at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. The North America Family Business Report from Brightstar Capital Partners, it found more than 60% of family-owned companies, they don't have a formal succession plan. why are there so many companies without plans for the next generation?
Yeah, it's such an interesting question. It's not because they don't know it's important, I don't think. I mean, everybody realizes that you know, if you say you want to stay owned in the family for a long time, then you need to have a plan to pass it down. So I don't think it's being naive. I think it's that it's hard, and I'm sure Nathan can talk about some of this. But if you think about the alternative, I'm not in a family-owned business. I could be private or public, right? As I think about when do I want to retire and who do I want to replace me, it's hard enough to think about, am I ready to go? And particularly if you're a founder generation of a business, often very hard to let go of something that they've worked so hard to create, right? Mm. So there's that own personal piece. But in the end of the day, if it's not my family, I think through, okay, do I have anyone in this company behind me that I think could run this? And if so, how do I make sure they're prepared? If not, should I be looking for someone outside the business? Or, you know, maybe this business needs to be sold or transitioned to someone else, right? But if it's in my family, oftentimes the presumption of succession is that it would go to a family member. And then that becomes really complicated, because if I have more than one child in the business, or if I'm not sure my child is going to be successful at this, or if I don't want to saddle them with the stress of running a company where their siblings may be co-owners in that business with them, there's just a lot of complexity there. I also see with the MBA students that I teach at Kellogg School of Management, you know, that they have new ideas and they're excited to come into the business and try new and different things. And oftentimes there's a resistance of that from elder generations who want to continue to do things the way that they've been doing them in the past, or feel like they have the benefit of having seen what succeeded and failed in the past, and that maybe the next generation coming in, while energetic, could be a bit naive. So you can often have tension about what direction you want to take a business in. So for a lot of these reasons, I think people avoid the difficult conversations around how they're going to pass down the business, because they're afraid that they don't have someone capable, or that they don't have alignment among the current generation and the next generation around how the business should be run.
Mm, they're so sensitive because it not only involves the direction and the philosophy of the business, but it also gets into personalities. It's very much a human decision as well.
Well, and on top of that, I wanted to go back to something that I think is very important that Nathan was saying before. You know, the level of stress that is put on someone when there's no distinction between your sort of family and home life and your business life, they all become blended into one system, right? And mm-hmm. so if I make someone unhappy, if I choose one child over another, or I tell my children I don't think they're qualified to run this business, I still have Thanksgiving with them. Mm-hmm. I still have, you know, they may still even live under my roof. How are their, you know, if I have grown children with spouses, how is that spouse going to take the news about, you know, who I've chosen to be my successor? So there's a lot of emotional complexity that comes into this that can make it really challenging.
Nathan, you help companies create succession plans. What does that process look like?
It's messy.
In a word.
And that's kind of one of our pitch lines is, you know, we're at that intersection of messiness. And to kind of backpack on what Jennifer said, you know, a lot of these intimately closely held businesses, 85% of their net worth is concentrated in one asset. It's their business. And so when you think about the unwinding phase, it's not like you just walk away with a 401k or a retirement plan into retirement. You also have to figure out what to do with your largest asset. And two is really understanding the value of that asset. And we're watching that being played out in a family business in the courts today. But many business owners truly do not know the real value of their business. They take a guess at it. And therefore, internally within their family, they have what we call a wealth gap. Do I have enough to confidently walk into retirement? And then we have what we call a value gap in the business. Do we truly understand what the value of that business is? And sometimes we focus on the third element, which is what we call the profit gap. What could or should it be worth in order to transfer? And so as we look at these things, it's really, that's the messiness or the complexities that Jennifer was saying, is not only the human side, but really just the financial side of, if this is a high concentration of my wealth, how do I unwind this so that I get enough and yet don't really squeeze the company too much financially so that it can survive throughout generations as well. And so it's messy, it's complex, and it requires a lot of expertise. And my last point I'll throw into this part of the segment is, this is where owners have to surround themselves with a group of experts. To think that you're going to pick up all these skills suddenly and work through this process and do it once. Most of these business owners sell their business once. And to think that you're going to do it perfectly the first time in such an incredibly important topic, I really encourage owners to think through that and give themselves ample time to assemble the right team and get yourself educated so that you can confidently run your business and keep it going without trying to be the expert in everything.
Nathan Brinkman from Triumph Wealth Management in Madison, a family-owned business, and Jennifer Pendergast from Northwestern University. As we look at family firms here in Wisconsin and elsewhere, challenges and opportunities, you can join in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Jennifer, what is the role of like boards of directors who are a little bit more removed maybe than the CEO and the other C-suite offices in terms of succession and what that thinking is like?
Great question. First of all, let me sort of pound the drum for the notion of a board as a great tool and a resource in a family business. And I think even in earlier stage family businesses, oftentimes a founder would say, well, I don't want to listen to or need to listen to someone because I own all of this company and I know how to run it. But I think of it as, you know, at the very least, this kitchen cabinet of smart people who are well-intended and want to help you achieve your dream of sustaining this business across generations. So who wouldn't want a group of people like that to be a sounding board and help them? They can be really useful in a time of succession because of your point about being a little bit more removed. There's an objectivity that they can bring if the retiring generation is willing to listen to them around the qualifications and capabilities of the potential next leaders. If they feel a true sort of fiduciary sense of responsibility to the company, they can also be the ones that are thinking about the risk of making sure that there's good financial planning in place so that the owner is prepared to be able to step down. They can be looking at making sure that there's good support systems in place for any next generation leaders, so that they have good people around them. I don't want to discount also the fact in succession that, you know, when you're talking about leadership succession in a family business, every one of the employees is watching and wondering what's going to happen. Mm. And so one of the big risks is, if they don't feel like this business is going to be in good hands, do I want to stay in a place where, you know, yes, it's great to be in this family-owned business environment, but what if there's not adequate planning? And so I worry the business is going to have to be sold because the founder hasn't put, you know, either financial plans in place or a succession plan. All of a sudden, I'm not going to be working at the place I thought I was before. Or what if I'm not feeling good about the caliber of the next leader that's going to come in, or they're going to take the business in a very different direction, or they're not going to care as much as the current owner.
And that could create uncertainty. I want to pause right there with Jennifer Pendergast, family business consultant at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management, Nathan Brinkman, founder of a financial planning and investing advisory. You can join in. Call in with a question, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. From beloved family-run restaurants to giant global manufacturers that have their roots in Wisconsin, think SC Johnson & Son, Kohler, We examine the dynamics of family-run firms and how they're changing. Call in with a question you can share at any point, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Nathan Brinkman is founder and CEO of Triumph Wealth Management in Madison. Jennifer Pendergast is here, teaches at the John L. Ward Center for Family Enterprises at Northwestern University. And Dan Hartung founded the agribusiness firm Hartung Brothers with his twin brother when he was 17 years old. Dan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate.
Good morning. Tell us about Hartung Brothers and how you and your brother founded this company.
Well, we obviously started it a long time ago. it'll be 50 years here in January 25, so it's been an interesting ride for sure, but we got started farming just commercial crops and then got into seed production in the Madison area and then got into vegetable production in the mid-80s, and that really took us pretty much all over the country, and we added some additional. We're also in the fertilizer business for about 12 years, 15 years, I guess, and just kind of just gradually grew as people needed additional services. We just grew the business, and now we operate in, I think, 5 states, in Hawaii, plus with Hawaii, and also in Ontario. We do a lot of cucumber production in Ontario between Detroit and Niagara Falls.
Mm. Sounds like your company kept looking to meet needs, evolving, maybe at times reinventing itself. Is that fair?
I would say that's fair. We've made all of our, I guess, moves and made all of our money on doing things other people don't want to do. And that could be a food processor that doesn't want to be involved in the ag side but still needs the raw product to run their plant, a seed producer that has a certain need that with our irrigated production could solve. So pretty much that's how we've grown the business.
And along the way, Hartung Brothers grew to include all of your siblings. Did you set out to keep it as a family company?
I think so. I mean, it wasn't, I guess, wasn't absolute. Everybody had to join in. Both my parents were both involved in other businesses. My dad managed a large farm co-op in Cottage Grove for 35 years, and my mom was in the Amway business for probably 40 years. And so they're both excellent mentors. They were never involved, day to day in the business, but certainly taught us well along the way, and were great examples.
Over the decades, how have you gone about resolving differences in the family business? Differences in what markets to enter, differences in what services to offer. How do you negotiate that?
That's really never been much of an issue for us. If it was a good opportunity, and again, it's got to be presented well, and not everything we do is good. So we're not adverse to failure, we've done a number of things that have not worked out, but we learn and we move on, and we've been successful, so I think that's it's always easier if you're successful at things. It'll cloud out the failures, or at least hopefully you got more successful things than failures. So at this point, it looks we certainly have had that, but they do staying, but nobody ever gets, I guess, at any of our board meetings, no one's saying why didn't we do or why we did that or shouldn't have done it. Very, very. I mean, we discuss things thoroughly, and then once it's decided, then we're all in.
Hmm. Jennifer, is Dan's story typical for how family companies are formed?
I think so. You know, a couple of things I heard. One, he said, "I guess we started thinking this way that we wanted it to be family owned." I mean, I think in the beginning, and I can't speak for him, but generally people are just trying to make sure they get a business off the ground, right? Mm-hmm. So this is something we're trying to do. We're thinking about day to day. The focus is very much operationally making the business work and adjusting as needed. The other piece I love about the story is, you know, over time, what business you're in evolves to meet your needs as well as to meet, you know, the needs of being successful. And, you know, one of the things I had mentioned earlier was that, you know, rarely is a business that's been around, you know, for 50 years or 100 years or more than that, doing what they did, you know, in the same business, making the same things that they started out doing. So the key is the flexibility to evolve with the times to be able to, you know, adjust to what the family is capable of doing and willing to take on, but also, you know, the world changes around you. So that flexibility to be able to adapt is really important.
Dan, I understand your twin brother recently retired. What are your plans for the company as you and your siblings look toward retirement?
Well, we're in the process of I guess, looking at how do you, you know, I guess that very issue is you know, we're in the midst of it right now with trying to transition these various departments over to non-family member leaders and managers. Nobody has any desire to really to sell their stock or to get out of the business at this time. So I don't, we're going to continue on and try to do it with non-family management, of which a lot of our departments are already managed that way. So it's now just getting to be, you know, get the guys further up, whether it be the, you know, in vice president positions. Eventually, we'll be, you know, we'll have to get my successor. Mm-hmm. I'm not planning on going anywhere anytime real soon. So at this point, I'm more focused on getting these other positions so they're well, you know, not only the guy's in that position, but he's had a couple of years in it so that we really know we've got the right guy.
Nathan, what comes up for you as you hear Dan's story?
Well, it's just a reflection of, you know, what he didn't say is the humility and humbleness of if you like pickles, you've for sure had one of the cucumbers that's been pickled by our twin brothers. So they have a vast network as well as in the corn and egg industry. And going back to mom and dad being supportive and helpful, even though they weren't right in the business, it's very rare to have a family, and Dan didn't really mention how many are there, but he's got a number of siblings that have been involved in that business, and yet they still get together for things like Thanksgiving and Christmas, and it's really about the family values that that have been bestowed upon that family, and I'll specifically call out his mom, Lorna. When he said Amway, she was an incredibly entrepreneurial spirit of which resonated down to the next generation and likely will go to the third generation as well. So I just think of, again, the messiness we talked about. What happens, you know, when you have a twin brother that retires and yet Dan is still raring to go and stay in that helm every day and doesn't plan on changing. And that goes back to the sophistication of everything is not equal and fair. It just has to be planned around.
We're talking about the role of family businesses in the economy, and especially here in Wisconsin. Nathan Brinkman, founder and CEO of Triumph Wealth Management. Dan Hartung is co-founder of Hartung Brothers Agriculture Company. And Jennifer Pendergast is from Northwestern University and works as a consultant to family-run businesses. You can join in with your questions and comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Jennifer, what should people consider before going to work for a family-owned business?
So first of all, I think that we can't put all family-owned businesses in one bucket, right? Just like any business. So I think I would want to understand what's the family's role in the business. How connected are they to it? Is it something that they want to be in for the long term? A lot of families are very good about being very vocal about their values and how those play into the business and the history. I'd love to see, if I were going to work somewhere that there's a pride in the family, I'd want to know how connected the owners are to the business and how committed they are to the business. I think those things are, you know, important if you're worried about, you know, committing a long-term career. You know, I'd want to see a certain level of professionalism in managing the challenges that can happen in a family business. So I had mentioned before, would love to see, you know, that there's a strong board of directors or an advisory board. I would want to know that there's something that families frequently put in place around, you know, rules that govern the family's ability to be employed in the business. So can any family member come into the business, or do they need to meet the same requirements as anyone coming in from the outside? That's something that I would want to look at as well. And so I think a lot of those things, it's always telling to me how vocal or outspoken families are about some of these things, about their pride in the business. Do they give back to their communities? Do they talk about their origin stories and their founders and the values that those brought to the business? Are they making an effort to be well organized as a family? Does the family get along with each other, or is there dissension among the family members? You know, those are things that are going to be a little bit harder to tell. So you may have to ask other employees about them. They're not going to show up at first blush, but I'd want to see that the best of a family business, which is the strengths around values and commitment, are there, and the potential worse of, which is, you know, lack of family cohesion, maybe conflict in the family, isn't present.
Mm. Dan, how do you create boundaries, like at the Thanksgiving table? Is it like no talking about work, or does it matter? Is everyone pretty easygoing? What is that like in terms of work and family?
Well, from the start, we set it up that we're I guess, how do you want to say this? We didn't set it up that you're automatically in the business, I guess. So if one of my brothers or sisters would pass away, or their stock would be bought back by the business, we wouldn't automatically go to the family. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of a, you know, everybody wanted to be able to pick their partner. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I've got six brothers and two sisters in the business, and a brother-in-law that are all shareholders. But we all knowingly had these people come into the business, and we did not want to have it set up. It wasn't heir to you or whatever. That's the way we set things up. But we truly run it. I mean, we really try to be, you know, cognizant of the fact that it's a business, and we run the business, and our you know, personal lives, but we certainly all. We all get along real well, so that's always a big help. But and I would say, from a disagreement standpoint, we just don't have a lot of them, because nobody, you know, really comes up with, if it's a bad idea, they smoke it out themselves usually. I mean, there's always, you know, when we're looking at distributions, you know, some people want more, some people want less. There's reasons for both, and you ultimately put it to a vote. I don't think we've had more than one vote in 48 years. It was not unanimous.
Mm.
Once the discussion got done and the reasoning got put on the table.
Dan Hartung is founder of a Madison-based agribusiness firm with his twin brother. Nathan Brinkman, founder of a wealth management and financial advisory firm in Madison. And Jennifer Pendergast consults with family enterprises, researches this aspect of the economy at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. Call in with a question. You can share your comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We focus on family-owned businesses and learn about their challenges and their future in Wisconsin and beyond. Call in with a question. Share what's on your mind at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Nathan Brinkman and Dan Hartung run family firms. Jennifer Pendergast is here, consults on and researches these businesses and is an adjunct professor at Northwestern University. Let's bring in Michael in Superior. Michael, hi. What is your situation?
Hi. I have a little four-year-old son. And I own a business relatively young. What's a good way to get him involved in the business? Because I want to leave it to him one day. I know if you push him too hard, he might pull away. And if you don't get him involved enough, he might not be interested. What's a good way to get him involved?
Michael, thank you for that question. Jennifer, how do you walk that line?
Well, first of all, I commend you for thinking about this early on. There's research that suggests that passing on an entrepreneurial spirit in families occurs early. So it's literally the simple stuff like the take your kid to work. And when I ask family businesses the stories of their first memories, they're often sitting in the office, going to work with dad, getting to ride it along in the truck if it's on a route, or getting to see some of the business firsthand. I was recently in the office of a business owning family where now it's going to the fourth generation, but they had actually like toys sitting in the office for the kids to come play and sit when their grandpa went to work. So I remember talking to a business owning family that makes cosmetic products, and they said during COVID, their kids came to the office because they were making hand sanitizer to help in the COVID efforts. And the kids actually thought that what their mom and dad did was stir the vats of the stuff that they were making. And so maybe the kids don't get exactly what you do, but this excitement of, hey, this is what we do, or driving down the street, you know, that's something that, you know, that we're involved with somehow. I think you can create this pride in what you do. So even just giving them exposure to the little things, you know, things that may be kid friendly, that they could be involved with. I do think there is a definite concern about putting too much burden or expectation on them. So I think sending the message that, you know, I would love for you to be here someday, but the business can also be a means to an end, which is if we do it successfully, you know, we generate money that you can use to pursue something that you're passionate about too. So they don't feel sort of an obligation or a fear that they're going to let a parent down. Mm. The other thing, just as a quick aside, I would say is, you know, oftentimes, you know, any job is stressful, but being the owner of something is very stressful, right? Because other people are depending on you for employment. And if your job doesn't work out, you can't just necessarily go to the next place, right? So being very careful about editing yourself, about what you're saying around your spouse or friends, about maybe frustrations that you bring home from work. You have to be a little bit careful around kids. And then the other thing is making sure that you still make time for family. If they see the business as this sort of the most important child of the family or something that doesn't allow you the flexibility to have time with them, I think it can be something that they resent over time. So making sure that you're still making space for family so they view this as a positive thing, not something that's taking you away from them.
Michael, thank you so much for the call. Nathan, this is personal. What is the succession plan for your own company? What can you share?
Well, that Michael's question resonates with me. I remember as a young child, my parents owned an office product store, and I counted pencils, and our reward was pizza. And when I graduated from college, my grandfather, who was a farmer, family-owned business, said I was a lucky kid because I got to work half days. I just got to pick which 12 hours. So out of my three children, one of them is interested, in fact, is licensed in the securities industry, and is my rule was they have to go work somewhere for 2 to 3 years because I'm a great coach, but I'm a terrible trainer. So she's getting training right now at a different organization. But my advice, Michael, is this, is make it fun. There are times in every business that are rough spots. I've been a student and a steward of this process for a long time. I won't go through all the credentials, but just for 20 years, I've been studying this. And one of the things that resonated with me many years ago was just to share life with our kids. And two of my children have no interest. They didn't like the ups and downs, and they didn't like the gyrations of what happens. But my daughter happened to click onto it. But we were very transparent with her when times were good, when times were bad, good days, bad days. But most important, just to make it fun and to communicate with them of, this is my passion. This is something that I care intimately and deeply about. And I think your kids pick up on that. If it's just a job, they'll pick up on that as well. And then my last piece of advice is take care of yourself financially. So in order to successfully transfer a business, you have to be able to afford to do that. And so I've been planning around that for a long time, just so I'm not dependent on my business or the value of that business necessarily to enjoy, you know, my last stage of life here in retirement.
And Dan Hartung, you have the last word here. Advice on those kiddos who are coming up behind you and, you know, the grandchildren in our, you know, 15, 20 seconds. Any advice there?
Well, we've got 80 some nieces and nephews here, so you really just got to let them choose. I mean, you can make it as pleasant or not, but certainly we have a lot of nieces and nephews will come out and spend time with their grandkids and so on. They go out and spend time with their.
They see pieces of it. Yes. Yep. Thank you all for joining us. Dan Hartung founded agribusiness firm Hartung Brothers at the age of 17. Jennifer Pendergast, adjunct professor at the John L. Ward Center for Family Enterprises at Northwestern University. And Nathan Brinkman, founder, CEO, and president of Triumph Wealth Management in Madison. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.